From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in for Suzette Gerlot, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me to react to President Obama's State of the Union address, the release of U.S. sailors from Iranian custody, and Turkey's response to a terrorist attack in Istanbul.
This puts Turkey clearly at war with ISIS and in the coalition of powers trying to fight ISIS.
Then, our producer, Brian Hardzinski, talks with anthropologist Don Kulik. Even though there are countless public services available in Sweden and Denmark for people with disabilities, that's not the case with their private sexual lives.
You can either ignore it and hope it goes away, which it won't, or you can find ways of actually facilitating sexuality without actually having sex.
We'll compare the approach of these two Scandinavian countries. But first, this hour's news headlines. This is World Views. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and we're joined today again by Joshua. Joshua, President Obama gave his last State of the Union this week and mentioned a couple of interesting international issues, which you're very familiar with. One of them obviously being the situation with ISIS, or ISIL as he calls them. And this week, we again experience a situation in Turkey with a bombing in Istanbul, the tourist center, and a reaction from the Turkish government. What are we to make of that?
Right. Well, Turkey was furious. You know, don't mess with Turkey, because this bombing took place at the very heart of tourism. Tourism is a $30 billion industry in Turkey.
It's killing 10 Germans, the German nationals.
10 Germans. I mean, and here are the Germans being so good to the refugees and so forth. So Turkey went on the attack. 500 different places along the border with Syria and Iraq, Turkey launched cannon fire at ISIS points. They claim to have killed 200 different members of ISIS. We don't know if that's true or not. But this puts Turkey clearly at war with ISIS and in the coalition of powers trying to 60 countries trying to fight ISIS. So that's the good news for the United States. Of course, it's very bad news for Turkey. It sends a real shudder. And it underlines once again how dangerous it is to play footsie with Islamic terrorists. We did it in Afghanistan. We got Al-Qaeda. Turkey's tried to do it in Syria, and it's come back to bite them.
So if we're talking about Turkey and we're talking about their retaliation about ISIS or against ISIS, where do the Kurds fit in here? We're also seeing perhaps some attacks being led by them. What is the situation? Kind of seems like this weird triangle of interest.
It is a triangle. And Turkey is terrified that the Kurds of Syria, the dominant political group amongst the Kurds of Syria is a PYD, which is really a branch of the PKK. This is the major Kurdish group, political group in Turkey that has been fighting a war with the central government of Turkey for the last 30 years. Over 40,000 Turks, both Kurds, mostly Kurds and Turks, have been killed in this low-grade war that's been going about. And Turkey is very worried that the Kurds could secede, taking 15% of the population. The Kurds are roughly 15, perhaps 20% of the Turkish population of 80 million. And they are a predominant group in the east of Turkey. So Turkey is very worried about a secession problem, about a terrorism problem, and they have been hounding the Kurds of Syria. So they've been using ISIS against the Kurds of Syria. So it has been a triangle. And it underlines how difficult this region is for the United States to navigate in.
Well, and obviously sitting right there on the border, this is a particularly important issue for them, and they're particularly vulnerable.
It is indeed. And you know, that's the good news, that we have another partner against ISIS. But look at Indonesia. Big bomb in Indonesia. What's going on there?
Yeah, we're just getting news this week. I guess on Thursday there was an attack, a coordinated attack, and ISIS has claimed responsibility. This is interesting because so much of our attention has focused on Iraq or Syria in terms of ISIS or some of their attacks in Western Europe. But we haven't paid a lot of attention to Indonesia, and this was a major string of attacks. And we will have to wait and see exactly what comes out of that information and, you know, what the government's response is there. But Indonesia was kind of seen as being somewhat free of ISIS involvement, haven't had a lot of recruits from the country go and try to train in the Middle East. So this is a change of events and perhaps a flexing of the muscles. But moving on from ISIS, one of the other issues that President Obama hit on was the situation with Iran. Of course, his State of the Union was on Tuesday, and just a couple hours before he spoke, 10 U.S. military members were apprehended as their boat apparently went into Iranian waters. And the president didn't say anything about this in the State of the Union, but the next day they were released. And this seems to signify a change in our relationship with Iran, or a positive step for diplomacy.
Certainly, Secretary Kerry is spinning it that way, saying, look, if this had happened a year ago, we would never have gotten their release in 24 hours. And that there's a constant dialogue. Things are going better. Of course, it also comes at the same time that Iran is destroying one of their major refining plants. And the treaty is really getting some teeth. And it looks like good news. So hopefully we're not going to see the end of Iran. Iran is flexing its muscles in the Persian Gulf. Iran wants to be the major power in the Persian Gulf, and that's going to cause friction between the United States and Iran in the years to come.
Well, lots of news, as always, coming out of the Middle East. Perhaps the situation with Iran is a positive news, and we'll wait and see what develops there. Thank you, as always, Joshua.
It's a pleasure.
If you have any thoughts about this discussion or any questions, let us know on our website, kgou.org. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. You can also follow Joshua at Joshua_Landis, where he posts photos, articles, and links to his work on his widely read blog, Syria Comment. Our program is also available as a podcast, and you can subscribe to the full show or to individual segments through iTunes. Next, we'll talk with Dan Kulik. He's an anthropologist in Sweden who studies sex and disability in Scandinavian countries. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. This half hour, we're joined by Dan Kulik. He's an anthropologist at Uppsala University in Sweden, where he's leading a 10-year study examining vulnerability and the types of resources it demands. He's best known for his work about the sexual lives and rights of disabled individuals, especially in Scandinavian countries. He spoke with our producer, Brian Hardzinski.
Dan Kulik, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
I'd like to start by talking about your latest book. It's called Loneliness and Its Opposites: Sex, Disability, and the Ethics of Engagement. And it centers on how Denmark and Sweden handle issues of sexuality and disability. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the background of these issues in those two countries and maybe give me a brief overview of this book?
Well, I think first it's important to understand why this is an important issue. Sexuality and disability, many people think it doesn't really concern them. Many people think that it's an issue that is very peripheral to, you know, many of the problems that we have in the world today. The fact is that sexuality is a marker of adulthood. So one of the differences between being a child and being an adult is that as an adult, you can decide about your sexuality. You can decide whether to have sex. You can decide who you would like to have sex with. As a child, you can't do any of those things. So it's really one of the most important markers of division between being a child and being an adult. And what one finds is that people, adults who have disabilities, who have significant disabilities, are often, actually usually, prevented from having any kind of sexual contact by people who care for them. And so what we wanted to do in this book is to look at how that actually plays out in practice, how it works, because many people don't know anything about that. It's not a topic that is widely researched. It's not a topic that people are particularly willing to talk about. So the book is about it's a comparison between Sweden and Denmark. And the reason we wanted to compare two social welfare societies is that if you look at a place like the United States, it's really about money. So if you have money, you can pretty much do whatever you want. In a social welfare society like Sweden or, you know, most of Europe, the state actually provides care. So the state gives you things and the state cares for you in ways that really can only be dreamed about here in the United States. But what that means is the state provides care. But what we found is that in Denmark, the state also facilitates a sexual life, facilitates sexual education. It facilitates human dignity in a way that isn't done in Sweden. Another reason we wanted to compare those two countries is that for Americans, for example, the difference is very not really known. There's, you know, it's Scandinavia, and Americans think of Scandinavia as utopian in many ways, sexually liberal, free, and that is true to a certain extent. But there are very important differences between the Scandinavian countries as well.
I want to pick up on that notion of comparison because a lot of your earlier work has focused on Brazil as well. So I'm a little curious as to what are some of the differences in how these issues are viewed, not just between, you know, these social welfare states, as you mentioned, and capitalist countries like the United States, but also between, say, the global north and the global south and perhaps some of these underdeveloped countries.
Well, again, that would depend on what issue you're discussing. In many ways, this issue of disability and sexuality, it really is a different kind of issue in a place like Scandinavia than it would be in a place like Brazil, partly because welfare societies actually do provide care. And also, people can live in group homes in places like Sweden and Denmark. In a place like Brazil, which is much more like the United States in that there's not a lot of social welfare, it is very different. Many people, many adults with disabilities would be living at home. And for their development as adults, that is a very different kind of thing because living at home with your parents sort of puts a brake on, you know, what you can do. If your parents don't want you to do things, you just don't end up doing them. Whereas if you're living in a group home, you have much more independence. Or if you're living independently, as, you know, here in the United States, you have the movement for independent living. And that is also an incredibly important movement for people with disabilities. So if you're living independently, you can do a lot of stuff. If you're living in a group home, you can also do a lot of stuff. If you're living at home with your parents, it's not going to happen often.
That's Don Kulik. He's an anthropologist in Sweden who studies the intersection of sex and disability. You can find a link to his book, Loneliness and Its Opposite, on our website, kgou.org. More of our conversation right after this break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in for our host, Suzette Grelot. This half hour, we've been hearing from anthropologist Don Kulik about the sexual health of people with physical and intellectual disabilities, especially in Scandinavia. He's been speaking with our producer, Brian Hardzinski.
You just kind of touched on that argument for safety for those with disabilities versus you know, the idea of free will and what the state's role is in that. In your book, you discuss what you're calling a capabilities approach and an aspect of normalization. Can you explain a little bit more about how that plays a role in these debates regarding the rights of sexuality and disability?
Well, I think that when people talk about sexuality and disability, a very common way of talking about it is in a rights discourse. That is to say that people will say that sexuality is a right. That's a very problematic argument to make because if sexuality is a right, then what exactly is it a right to? Or, you know, more to the point, who exactly is it a right to? So the way we think about it in this book, and I think the more important way of thinking about it, is by using what is called the capabilities approach, which looks at justice, social justice in a society, not so much in terms of rights, but in terms of the society's facilitation of individual capabilities. So basically what a person can do. So if a society facilitates a person's ability to do what they can do, it doesn't give them things, but it's like, can you, if you would like to have a sexual life, let us provide you with education about sexuality. Let us provide you with help to have a sexual life. And that doesn't mean that we have sex with you. It doesn't mean that a society is going to provide people with sexual partners. But for example, in Denmark, where I worked and lived in group homes, what it means is that people provide education to people with disabilities and also provides them with help, concrete help. So if somebody wants help, for example, to be able to masturbate, and that seems like it might be a rather esoteric kind of problem. But people, imagine if you can't move your limbs, you can't touch yourself, you can't do it yourself. And there's two ways of dealing with that as somebody who works for and with and loves and cares for people with disabilities. You can either ignore it and hope it goes away, which it won't. Or you can find ways of actually facilitating sexuality without actually having sex with that person. And that's the sort of – so what that does is it facilitates the capability to understand sexuality and to have a sexual life. And that's the capabilities approach. Just as we say – we think that, you know, as part of a life with dignity – part of a life with dignity is the capability to reach out to other people, to love other people, to have a romantic and erotic life. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody does it. That doesn't mean that everybody, you know, can do it. But part of a just society is to provide the possibilities for people to do that. And so that's really what the capabilities approach. It's not about saying I have the right to sex. It's about saying that every individual should be provided with the capability to have an erotic life, should they choose, should they want.
How has this research had an impact in these two countries? Has it affected how Denmark and Sweden are approaching this?
Well, the research is a comparison between Sweden and Denmark, and what we found is that in Denmark they have a very robust and very a great system, frankly, for doing this. In Sweden, it's the opposite. In Sweden, it's more the situation you find in most other countries in the world, which is that people are afraid of the topic. And so their way of dealing with it is that they prevent people with disabilities from having any kind of sexual life. In Sweden, there's a sort of a mantra, and the mantra is from people who work with people with disabilities, the mantra is, if I don't do anything, at least I haven't done anything wrong. In Denmark, it's really the opposite, and that is if I don't do anything, then I really have done something wrong because I'm actually not allowing this person to develop in a way that, you know, most adults would like to develop. So what has happened as a result of the book in Sweden is that the discussion is now being taken up. It's like, what can we actually do to do this in a way that doesn't put people in the position? I mean, one of the fears when you talk about sexuality and disability, one of the fears is that if you take it seriously and if you think that how do we facilitate the possibility of an erotic life for people with significant disabilities, that is to say people who require help, the fear is that I'm going to have sex with them. And what we see in Denmark is that that's not at all what happens. It's not about having sex with people. It's not about sending people to sex workers. There are many other ways of facilitating sexual education and a sexual life that don't necessitate any of that. And I think that once people realize that, the conversation opens in a way that it isn't open now.
Speaking of opening that conversation, I want to shift and talk about one of your best-known books that involves a Brazilian soccer player who was caught with transgender prostitutes. Can you tell me a little bit of background about this story and how it kind of changed or may have changed gender meanings across Brazil and other Latin American countries?
Well, I mean, the book isn't about that. The book that I have written is about transgender prostitutes called travestis in Brazil. And what you're referring to is an article about a scandal that occurred with Ronaldo, who is one of the best-known soccer players in the world. He retired a number of years ago, but anyone who knows anything about soccer will know very well who Ronaldo is. He's one of the most distinguished and awarded soccer players. And in 2008, he basically picked up three prostitutes who all turned out to be transgendered prostitutes. And one of them made it known that they were all transgender prostitutes. So he was mocked, roundly mocked. He denied knowing that they were transgendered prostitutes, which is what every single man who has ever been found out to have been together with a transgender prostitute says. They all say, oh, I didn't know. He knew. Everybody knows. It's always a lie when they say that. And really what happened when this – everyone in Brazil was very involved in this case because Ronaldo is so well known. And I think that what the case showed us is that there's a – it's a don't ask, don't tell situation. So the sort of traditional Latin American gender and sexuality – way of thinking about gender and sexuality is that a man can have sex with another man if he doesn't concern himself at all with the penis of that other man. The other one is a homosexual, but you can still be a man. So the transgendered prostitutes with whom I worked, for example, they're born men. They modify their bodies in various ways to look very feminine. They inject silicone. They take hormones. But they don't – they're not transsexual in the sense that they want to have a sex reassignment surgery. So they don't want to get rid of their penis. They love their penis. They think it's just fabulous. But they're together with men who are not homosexuals. So they themselves identify as homosexual. Their boyfriends, they say, are heterosexual. And the boyfriends themselves see themselves as heterosexual even though they're together with somebody who has a penis. That's the traditional Brazilian system. That is now sort of quaking, largely because of the AIDS period when different kinds of sexual understandings were really introduced and reinforced in Brazil. Brazilians travel a lot. There's just a lot of movement. So there's kind of a clash or an eclipsing of one sexual system by another. And the sexual system that is now coming into really play is that you can't have sex with a man. If you're a man, you can't have sex with a man without you being a homosexual. And really, historically, that's what happened in our own society. I mean, in the beginning of the 1900s, men who had sex with other men weren't homosexual if they penetrated them. And we still have it in the prison sort of system of sexuality. So there's an idea that men in prison who have sex with each other, the only one who is the homosexual is the one who is penetrated. The one who's doing the penetrating doesn't necessarily have to be homosexual. But what this whole case sort of did in Brazil is that it made Ronaldo, the soccer player, people doubted his masculinity. So I think that he probably thought, I can have sex with these people, these transgender prostitutes, and I'm still a man. What he discovered when this was publicized is that people started to say he's a viado, which in Brazil is a faggot. He's a faggot. So really it's one of those places where you see a kind of a sexual and gender system quaking and shifting and moving, a sort of, you know, tectonic shift going on. And that's not to say that it is a shift that it's not like one will disappear. One of these systems will disappear. I think that they're both going to coexist. But I think Ronaldo was very surprised to learn that people now see him as a queer.
It's fascinating research. And Don Kulik, I appreciate you taking the time to tell us about it on Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Brian Hardzinski's conversation with Don Kulik, an anthropologist at Uppsala University in Sweden. We have links to some of his work online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with support from the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Miranda Wilson prepared the research for this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this episode. For Joshua Landis, I'm Rebecca Cruz.